Yeah, so I want to start by first acknowledging that we're on stolen lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation who never ceded this land. So want to pay our respects to elders past and present. And don't know if you want to say more on that, Mariki?
Oh, no.
Okay, and so, yeah, for the workshop today, we've got Mariki here, who's from Woor, a member of Warriors of the Aboriginal Resistance, and we've also got Lucy from the Refugee Action Collective. So we wanted to have this conversation to bring together these two campaigns that have been mobilising people in really big numbers around issues of decolonisation and around refugees and the free movement of people, and talk about some of the overlaps and the parallels between the two struggles and those movements, and I guess ultimately, you know, talk about where this can go in terms of solidarity and working together with these campaigns. What kind of crossover there are. So, yeah, I'm Nicole. I forgot to introduce myself. So I'm going to be facilitating, but probably Lucy and Mariki will be doing a lot of the talking. We'll probably talk till around 12:30-ish or so, and then there's space for questions and, you know, comments from the floor and that sort of thing. And I think because it's being recorded, maybe come up and speak into the mics up here when you ask questions. So... yeah, I guess on that, we can just get started. So, yeah, so I wanted to, I suppose, start by throwing out the question of when we're talking about decolonisation and refugee campaigns, how important it is to acknowledge Aboriginal sovereignty and struggles for self-determination as a starting point for broader campaigns, and if that is an important point.
My name is Mariki, and I'm from the Gunai Gunditjmara Nations, Burun Garawangal, Jikang Garawangal. So basically I think, you know, when talking about refugees and people coming here and talking about sovereignty is essentially just a tokenistic gesture if you don't come here and understand the laws and the civil society that was here before colonisation. And I think that's really important for anybody coming here. But also, you know, I think that, yeah, I think that when people talk about sovereignty movement or sovereignty, it is simply only tokenistic unless you understand exactly the experience of genocide, but also... how our society ran beforehand.
It's very, very important, and something that Refugee Action Collective tries to take very seriously, both in terms of respect and respectfulness for the people who, you know, who have come here and have fought struggles against racism before us, but because of the profundity of the point of the connection in struggle between refugees seeking asylum in this country and, you know, Aboriginal people also, you know, at times seeking asylum from this very government. So there's a huge point there. I think it is really, really profound. For example, different refugee demonstrations that we've had where we've had a welcome to country from somebody who has given a genuine welcome, and the genuine welcome that refugees are not getting from this government or from any other force in this country, but they are given a genuine deep welcome from a traditional owner. That is a very profound revelation about, you know, which politics can welcome, which group of people can genuinely welcome here. And likewise, when we have refugees who give an acknowledgement of country at the beginning of a rally or at the beginning of their speech, it's again a very poignant thing of, I can acknowledge, and I acknowledge that there is genocide here. I acknowledge the racism of this state. I acknowledge your struggle, you know, and I am doing that while, you know, this racist government has been doing the exact opposite for the last 200 years. So, I mean, that's the starting point of, you know, of all all kind of public appearances of RAC, and it is very self-consciously an effort to make that connection. I think you're right that it often can be tokenistic. It can be very, you know, just a gesture. And I think it often does turn into that. But I don't think the refugee campaign can afford to overlook the fact of genocide, the fact of dispossession, and the fact of the original racism that this country started with.
And I also want to, you know, make the point that, you know, anybody that comes here that's not white will experience the same, well, very similar oppression, you know, as we have experienced with these governments and this society, you know, for the past 227 years. So that's a really important point to make too. So I think that and I'm a strong believer that both groups need to work together in strong solidarity in terms of survival and coping as well, and I think that we can rely on each other for that, and resisting.
Yeah, so those things around, yeah, the shared experiences of racism as well, like when we're talking about these issues, we're talking about the freedom of people to move, but also the freedom of people to stay. And so some of the parallels, I suppose, between refugee experiences and Aboriginal experiences is, you know, people being forced off their homelands, people being forced off the lands that is theirs, but also the constraint of movement of people across borders, so to seek asylum, you know, in places, and the detainment of people within those places. So I wondered if you wanted to talk a bit about the parallels between the campaigns in those ways as well. And I guess, yeah, like both campaigns challenge the border in a way, you know, both the movement of refugees and asylum seekers and decolonisation movements challenge the border and the nation state. So it would be interesting to hear both of your thoughts on that and, you know, your thoughts around the border in that way. So I hope that makes sense.
The current colonial border have no jurisdiction to make those laws, and that's really important for people to understand. They have no jurisdiction to make those laws on this country and this land and to say who can't come in here and who can. In terms of borders, we have borders here before the, you know, state borders and before the national border. They are our tribal borders where, you know, though, I mean, that we did have borders here, but they were never used to oppress each other. They were used to, you know, they were used for that was a part of our identity, and that's a part of our identity and who we are, and it's really important to us as Aboriginal people to be connected to our homes. But we have, in the process of violent forced occupation, been removed from that, and when we have, that's when we have become the sickest, when we're away from our home and our ceremony and our country and our people. And so we've been internally displaced in this country historically, and that is still happening today, right now. And the best example with that is the community closures. There is a refugee camp called Matagarup in Perth for Aboriginal people. There are people staying there in tents. There are Aboriginal refugees within this country too. So I think there are a lot of parallels within the struggles around being displaced and internationally as well from where you are. And I think this government has a lot to do, it has a huge role in what's happening in the wars happening overseas for people to even come here. I think that they should, and as an Aboriginal woman who has a connection to my country, I can't imagine what it's like to be moved off your land and country and have to move internationally for your own survival. But I think there are a lot of parallels in our struggles in that, from the colonial governments.
Yeah, I was going to make a similar point, actually. Like the people who are living in, Aboriginal people living in refugee camps currently, and I was just looking this morning as well, I was reminded that in 2009, Richard Downes from Umbloodawatch actually contacted the UN and made a submission for refugee status for the Umbloodawatch community, because they, same thing under the Northern Territory intervention, that community were displaced. They were no longer able to stay there. They were subject to the kind of force that, as Marinki says, our government is putting on other people on the other side of the world, but that's happening right here. So, you know, I guess the freedom of people to stay, the freedom of people to leave, that's intimately connected. I guess the point about challenging the border and challenging Australian national sovereignty, you know, Tony Abbott makes it so easy to see that that's their project by calling, you know, what they're doing Operation Sovereign Borders. It's such an anxiety on their part that they've actually called the project of repelling people, they did before they called it Border Force, they called it Operation Sovereign Borders. You know, like it's about asserting white Australian sovereignty over this land here, and that's the determined project. And it is a serious anxiety on the part of, you know, the Liberal Party and the Labor Party to maintain, you know, an ideological sense of control and a sense of nation, you know, despite the realities that persist of, and the realities, you know, and we've known this again for 200 years, the persistent fact is the Australian nation tried to erase Aboriginal people, you know, this land here, Melbourne, you know, within 5 years decimated 40% of the population, just like that. And that's still going, that process is still going in the Northern Territory, in Western Australia, here on the block in Redfern and so on. That's the continued process. But I think it's challenged by the fact that Aboriginal people still exist. Adam Good still points out, you know, the racism. Mariki still organises the mass rallies at the front of Flinders Street. You know, those sort of things just continually throw into question, well, whose sovereign borders, whose sovereign state, you know, is being run here? And I think, you know, the fact of refugees continuing to arrive by boat, so-called unannounced, unauthorised maritime arrivals, like they just project their anxiety right into that, you know, into that language. They are concerned, the ruling class is concerned about the arrival of boats and the punctures that makes into the narrative that this is a controlled, organised, rational system that we've got going on here, and it works and it's fine and don't worry about it. So, yeah, I think that boats and Aboriginal people and migrants in general really do question, you know, Australian nationalism in a way that is quite powerful. And, you know, that happens whether or not we're resisting, whether or not we're fighting. But when we are fighting, we're fighting together, it's an even more assertive and an even more kind of challenging fact for them.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because it's those anxieties that you talk about, and that's like a really good way of describing it, also point to the deep insecurity of a government that is formed on stolen land, you know, where there's like this legal edifice set up around like a very illegal occupation. And so the constant kind of anxiety and the constant coercion around controlling people and their movement and keeping them in detention and calling people illegal really points to the continued insecurity of that. So as much as that's a really forceful project, it's also one that, looking at the flip side, it's a really insecure project, and all the acts of resistance sort of show that there's a flip side to that as well, you know, to continue pointing to that. But yeah, I guess I also wanted to ask you about the, like, there's sort of parallels in languages and discourses around citizenship in both of these campaigns, and in particular, you know, the term illegal as a citizen, and there's parallels around, you know, deaths in custody and deaths in detention, and it sort of seems like there's that language in a way makes it possible for the state to exercise these really punitive and violent kind of forces around a group that is othered, that's sort of deemed as like almost foreign or othered in this country. So I wondered if you wanted to both talk to that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, I often think about this. And it's certainly the case actually everywhere where we haven't been wiped out, Aboriginal people are, I feel, essentially illegal to be here. Our children are overrepresented in out-of-home care, and we are filling up the prisons quicker than nobody's business. I mean, 80% of the juvenile justice centres in New South Wales are filled with Aboriginal children. We only make up 3% of this population. And I think that's across the board that for most peoples, but for Aboriginal people certainly it feels like it's illegal to just be Aboriginal, and it's becoming more obvious, and particularly with the case of Muiramul, he didn't want to identify his white name, and he was locked up for that, you know. There are many examples of when we try and assert our sovereignty and do an act. You know, we have to get fishing licences to fish on lands that we have fished on for 40,000 years. And if you don't, you are then fined. And if you don't pay that fine, it then, you know, you can end up in prison. So essentially it is illegal to be Aboriginal, and you are forced to assimilate to the Australian society in every aspect of your life, from your hair to your most intimate parts of your life. They want you to be white Australian, and every aspect of yourself there, you know, is compromised by that. So it's so ingrained to try and be an Australian person and be assimilated to be white. You are accepted in this Australian society if you act white. If you want to be white Australian, then that's okay. But if you want to point out racism, and if you want to act out of line, then you will pay for that, essentially.
I generally agree with that. I was going to make the point about the Aboriginal man in Western Australia who was taken into immigration detention because, they just didn't believe he was Aboriginal, despite the fact that the local land council would vouch for the fact that he, you know, for who he was and his, you know, his identity. The fact of him looking not white was enough for them to question him and throw him into immigration detention. The point that Mariki makes about there being a kind of a citizenship, an allowable citizenship that you can, you know, like if you're white, you're automatically there. If you're not, then, you know, you can be accepted into that realm, you know, by conforming or attempting to conform to the citizenship values that are becoming more and more, you know, overt, you know, about kind of accepting Western values and not taking up, not politically critiquing racism, you know, not politically critiquing anything, and so on. But even that, ultimately, like, it's not like this guy in Western Australia was, you know, at a rally or, you know, out for defending Aboriginal or refugee rights. He was just picked up because somebody thought that he didn't look right. So, you know, that's a consistent truth.
So, yeah, just on that one, I don't know if people in the audience would have heard of that case, but, yeah, that was a couple of months ago. A guy in WA was sent to the Yonga Hill Immigration Detention Centre, and the local land council in Perth had, agreed that he was Aboriginal, which is what he claimed to be, and Centrelink and the Immigration Department disputed that claim and said that he wasn't, and they did all sorts of facial recognition techniques and all this sort of thing to show, according to them, that they were claiming that he was Fijian and not Aboriginal. So then he gets put in immigration detention, and he's then also saying, you know, this is my land, where am I to go if even on my land I'm illegal and I'm locked up in immigration detention? So, yeah, it's I think, a really powerful example of how those two, you know, like these... The calling people illegal because they don't fit the image of, you know, an obedient white citizen or something. Also, I think that facial recognition technique also kind of harks back to, like, an earlier era of, like, eugenics, you know, like when they measured skulls and all this kind of stuff, of this, like, way of scientifically categorising people, which... You know, there's been so much work to dispute the validity of that, and to still see that kind of thing operates is pretty horrific. So, yeah, just to flesh out that example which you raised, in case people hadn't heard of it, which I think is a really powerful example.
Can I also just make a point? Last year, the Aboriginal Provisional Government have issued their own passports, and this is to, you know, in resistance to us not being Australian, and we're very, you know, steadfast on that. we are not Australian, and that's part of the problem of them, is them thinking that we are Australian and that we just want more welfare. But anyway, last year we went to Turtle Island and came back, and we used our Aboriginal passports. And if you don't have valid, by their ideas of valid documentation, you get sent back to where you came from. And so when you come through customs and you give them the Aboriginal passport, and they kind of, you know, they're very aggressive. They threaten to strip search, a friend of mine, and that's, you know, systemic sexual assault in my view. He was using that to force her to give her other Australian ID over. It comes up with a really interesting question, and they just don't know how to deal with it because they're confronted with this idea that when we're like, no, we're not Australians, we're Aboriginal, this is our documentation. They don't know what to do with it, and they just let us through. They let us into the airports through the customs without appropriate documentation because they have no idea what to do. If they're going to send us back to where we came from, it'd be nice if they could, you know, pay for a cab back home. But, you know, like, they don't know what to do with it, and I think the passports are being created to actually have international coding where we can travel through different borders. The Haudenosaunee people over in Turtle Island have their own passports. There was a Native women's lacrosse team that said to, I think it was Ireland, there was an international tournament there for lacrosse, and Ireland said that they, or England said that they wouldn't accept the documents, so the women didn't participate. If you don't accept who we are and recognise our identity, then we won't participate in your games. And those acts of your own sovereignty is really powerful for us to continue on to keep doing. So I'll be really excited when we get the documents to be able to do that, continue to do that.
Mm. In 2012, there was a ceremony here in Melbourne where refugees were... It was a citizenship ceremony, I suppose, where traditional owners gave refugees Aboriginal passports, and I don't think that got them anywhere half as close to customs, but it was a really strong assertion of that politics of whose state, whose sovereignty, whose right to issue, these kind of documents and so on. I was just going to pick up, though, on a different point about the deaths in custody, because, you know, the logic of making a person illegal does ultimately end in deaths in custody. It does end in brutality of the most extreme kind. And I was trying to explain... I was actually trying to explain this at a union meeting yesterday. I was trying to pass a motion about the Border Force Act and, the fact that now it's illegal for workers on Manus Island and so on and Nauru to blow the whistle about what's happening, the sexual abuse and so on. And there was a line in the motion that said this allows the sexual abuse to continue. And, you know, somebody wanted to move an amendment to say, you know, I mean, they're bad, the government's bad, but they don't actually want the sexual abuse to happen, do they? I mean, maybe it happens and they haven't been, you know, on the front foot enough to stop it happening, but they're not organising the sexual abuse. And I really wasn't on my game enough, so I'm going to do it now. But what I really should have said and wanted to say was, actually, yes, they are. That is actually the logic of deterrence. When you have made, the politics of the border such that, you know, you are not welcome, you cannot come here, and we will make it worse for you here than it is wherever you have been fleeing, then, you know, that is the logic of detention centres, hell holes, concentration camps, sexual abuse, and in fact, two murders on offshore detention, you know, a death very recently at Yonge Hill under very, very suspicious circumstances. These things just keep happening, and it's not an aberration. It's not, you know, a blip in a really bad system, you know, Serco wasn't checking its inmates frequently enough or whatever it was. It's actually the logic of making people illegal. And the same is true, and we knew this from the, you know, the whole campaign around deaths in custody, the whole, you know, the whole situation of warehousing Aboriginal people and making that the only option for Aboriginal people is to, you know, shove people into prisons and keep them there and then put them back in there and then keep them there for a long period of time. You're turning people into illegal, you know, you are illegalizing people, and the logic of that is death. It is killing them.
Mm. Or killing the Aboriginal in them.
Yeah.
You know, and that they either have to commit to the wider society or, you know, die. So assimilate or die. That's the option. And I think that's the option that they want many people who finally get refugee status here and they get to come here. You know, they have to assimilate as well, which I think, you know, is really sick. They treat people terribly here from different cultures, you know, speaking different languages, whether you can build a mosque in Ballarat. I mean, I think that's disgusting. But, you know, Ballarat has a long genocidal history of how they treated Aboriginal people. The Jajarurong people have had a hellhole experience with that place. And, you know, where you find where the colonisers were the most murderous, that's where they'll treat refugees the worst. And I've seen that pattern has happened. They have a basketball team called the Braves, and their mascot is an Indian. And they've got an Indian head, an Indian person's head on their bar in Ballarat. That's a thing in this state. You know, that's scary for me, you know, as an Indigenous person to see that. It's pretty serious.
Yeah, I think that's like a really interesting point to bring up as well, to point out the continuity that, I mean, I think often when these, like often especially when we're talking about sovereignty or we're talking about colonialism, it's talked about like it's a historical fact, but actually we're talking about a contemporary thing that's continuing to happen. Mm. And that kind of, I mean, we're talking before about the way in which there's this like push to have obedient citizens. And so if people contest, you know, the racism of the state, then they're, like, there's cause for them to be deported. Like, and we saw that with Adam Goods even just last week, you know, like this football player saying that he should be deported. And so, like, looking at that continuity as well around, like, what is citizenship and, like, that project of whiteness and creating, like, an increasingly white state of obedient people. And, you know, that's, like, part of the White Australia policy, that's colonialism, and that's what we're still seeing in, you know, in slightly kind of different, articulated in maybe slightly different ways, but essentially the same project.
There's millions of dollars. It's a huge industry, and mining companies, all different corporate players across the board, pump millions of dollars into Aboriginal children's programs to help them assimilate and achieve, to get good jobs, to have their say in Australian politics. It is the push to assimilate and remove yourself from your Aboriginality is it's horrific. You know, it's under the guise of reconciliation is if you kill the Aboriginal in yourself. That's what they want to reconcile on. And they are Reconciliation Council They are funded by Woodside and BHB Billiton. The original declaration for the Reconciliation Council had treaty in it. It doesn't have that anymore. They made no that consultation with Aboriginal people in this country around taking the clause of treaty out. They've replaced it with recognise, for us to be recognised into the Australian Constitution. We have to ask the Australian people for permission to be written into their constitution. So, I mean, that's what a treaty has been replaced with. I mean, for us to become a part of the Australian society has never been... It was better under John Howard. Right now, there's no chance in hell for us. Nothing.
I'm good. I've said it all.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you were talking when we first started about... like the importance of not just kind of tokenistically acknowledging sovereignty, and we've been talking about, and I guess like a main project of war is decolonisation.
Yes.
So do you want to talk a bit more on decolonisation and what that looks like in the context of these sort of discussions that we're having around partnerships and parallels between refugees and the movement of people?
Yeah, so I mean, decolonisation for war, I mean, that component of war is largely for Aboriginal people to, for lack of a better word, to re-indigenise ourselves, you know, come back from the assimilation processes. So that means learning our languages, learning, you know, some Aboriginal people don't even know where their nations are from. You know, that's obviously from the stolen generation. So that's a healing process for us, but it's also an act of resistance against the project of genocide, is to decolonise ourselves. So removing ideas around white supremacy from ourselves, our bodies, our minds, our societies, how we carry out politics, that's really important in terms of resistance as well. So they have to go hand in hand. Decolonisation is also recognising that, you know, our societies and the way we ran things before colonisation actually worked perfectly fine for us. So we need to move back to that. I think in humanity, the best way that we can almost move forward from the civilisation, this train wreck that we're all on right now, is to look at Indigenous cultures around the world and how those civilisations take care of the land, the environment, their people, and they've been dehumanised in colonial projects for as long as colonialism has existed. So to understand that, you know, localised, you know, I guess that's very similar, you know, localised, you know, politics, you're controlling your own politics and your things that impact you socially. So I guess that goes into decolonisation. So, you know, looking to your elders to drive your politics and within yourself and taking care of yourself within your own tribal nation, so rebuilding that. I guess that's a bit about decolonisation for us, and also that works, again, you know, that you're not committing to, you know, corporates, not using certain eating foods. You can go on forever and ever, decolonisation. It's not eating food that, you know, big super corporations put into our bodies that essentially will kill us in the end. And that's what's killing us. Diabetes is a huge killer in our communities. And so if we had diets and ate foods that we ate before, you know, before those foods were introduced, like, you know, in the mission days, mission ration days, like flour, sugar, and tea. So removing those ideas around, you know, what we eat. So, I mean, I guess decolonisation can go, it's an endless kind of possibility for us as Aboriginal people. And that's really important when we organise. And I think it's a different twist to Aboriginal politics. Not different, because there are, you know, my parents named me Mariki, but before that, they all people in my family had white names, so my family had practiced it before. But we've just named it now, so we are going back to what's important to us as Aboriginal people, and for survival purposes.
I guess the other thing that's really interesting in this context as well is the Aboriginal passports, and we were talking about that before. And, yeah, Lucy, you were saying how that has been, like, a really good act of solidarity as well in the, you know, the issuing of Aboriginal passports to refugees, and the West Papuan Freedom Flotilla was also a really good example of that kind of solidarity, where West Papuan refugees and Aboriginal people were using these Aboriginal passports, and that was the only travel documents that they were travelling with when they were going. And I think there's probably people that can speak to this more authoritatively than I can, but maybe in the questions and stuff to bring up. But, it's like, and in terms of decolonisation, talking about, like, the many different nations that are in Australia.
Yeah.
And then, or, you know, what we now call Australia, and how Aboriginal passports work with that, and what that process looks like, is something I'm really sort of curious about.
So Aboriginal passports obviously is not a form of decolonisation. That's more of asserting our sovereignty in an act of resistance. But in terms of the borders, do you want to talk about?
Yeah.
In terms of the colonial borders that we have now are different to Aboriginal borders.
I guess that's something you've already touched on a bit. And I was just interested in hearing a bit more about the Aboriginal passports and how that works. But I guess, like you said, that's actually kind of a slightly sort of separate politics to decolonisation in a way.
I guess it is certainly not so much decolonisation.
Mm.
It's more resistance.
But I guess talking about that and how those passports were used. I guess it's like a good point to also open up what does solidarity ideally look like between these two campaigns, and that's something I'd be interested in hearing from you both on.
Sure. I just think the possibilities are a little bit endless in this regard. Just last week, one of the best kind of, you know, I stand with Adam Goods moments was when a man on Manus wrote on his hand, "I stand with Adam Goods." You know, that kind of, it just, I don't know how many different ways to put it, the poignancy or the depth of that kind of solidarity is really, really profound because of what it reveals and because of how it kind of, it really does kind of draw the lines, I suppose, and say we are, you know, relentlessly on the side of Aboriginal people. We are relentlessly on the side against racism. You know, the Australian state, you know, it's locking us up. It's put us, you know, in this hellhole. It's torturing us on 1,000 different ways, and we can see that our future is tied up with the people fighting the racism of that state. So, you know, I guess that's one very small kind of one man's gesture on Manus Island, but it meant a lot more, and I think it points in the direction of a lot more. Amanda, who's just over there, made sure that we had, you know, a refugee contingent at all of the community closure rallies that were organised, all of the ones from a certain point, to saying, you know, like, we stand with the refugees who have been made refugees in this country, with the Aboriginal people who have been dispossessed very recently. You know, those kind of acts of solidarity are huge. And, you know, to be honest with you, I just think that, like, just to talk a little bit more kind of electoral politics, I do think that, you know, the extent to which Tony Abbott has made himself an offensive feature of Australian politics is, you know, is in some ways a gift, in that it unites people, you know, in a really strong way. It makes it clear that if you don't like the budget, if you don't like the way that Tony Abbott is treating, you know, you or your Medicare card or your public education and so on, then you have something to gain from solidarity with, you know, the other people who's really, really hurting. And I think, you know, we were talking just before about the success of all of the mobilisations this year, and I do think that to some extent is part of it. There is an anger at Abbott. There is an anger at, you know, the extent to which these kind of politics have been going for the last, you know, couple of years. And that's, you know, that's really kind of fertile ground. I sometimes people call me too optimistic about this particular thing, but that's funny because I'm usually very pessimistic. But I do actually see huge amounts of potential in mobilising people against racism in this country, and there are plenty of examples to show that when you are fighting racism of one kind, you know, like when you're fighting the racism of the Vietnam War, that is very, very quickly able to become also a fight about Aboriginal rights, a fight for land rights. When you're fighting against South African apartheid, you know, again, same thing. Pauline Hanson, you want to fight against the anti-Chinese racism. It's kind of impossible to do that unless you also fight against what she's saying about Aboriginal people. So, you know, the two cannot be disentangled.
I think that, you know, with the two groups working together, we are already, I mean, war and rise have a relationship together. And we certainly, you know, we have formed relationships with, you know, refugee groups from all, you know, all around. But I think when we are in the rally and I see, you know, Palestinian mob there, or, you know, you can see African people come, and all different kind walks of life come to our rallies and stand with us in solidarity, or we've had Indigenous peoples from all over the world come to our rallies, and it's so heartening to see because our fights are so similar. But I just think that it's really important for people to remember you will be treated like Aboriginal people. They did that. They're doing that now with fracking, and the farmers are freaking out because they feel like Aboriginal people are they feel like that right now. The basics card, that was tested on us. You know, what they do to us is what they'll do to you. And we need to stop it, before it continues onto your backyard. And our freedom is certainly tied up with yours in that sense. So it's not separated in that. So those mining companies that are shutting down communities in WA, they're going to come here to Victoria and do the same. In fact, mining companies are sniffing around the mission that I grew up in Gippsland. Fracking companies right now, that's happening right now. So that will come to your doorstep. So there's, you know, certainly a lot of yourself that will be tied up in that. And all these white farmers are freaking out. And it's like, you know, it's the cognitive dissonance, you know, to them and how freaked out they are at losing their land and their livelihood while they continue to make millions of dollars off the back of Aboriginal genocide it's almost laughable if it wasn't so serious. But, you know, I think that we'll always forever stand, you know, Aboriginal people, our freedoms are certainly tied up with the West Papuan mob, with Palestinians, with, you know, our brothers and sisters over in Turtle Island. We have a really strong bond with each other already. And, you know, with our African brothers and sisters, Aboriginal people will take care of anyone that comes to our shores, you know, as long as you'll take care of us.
I think that's a really good place to open it up to questions from the floor if people want to ask any questions or make any comments. And also thank you both. Do you want to come up and speak into the microphone? Maybe we'll pass one that way.
Thank you very much, three of you, and some great, it was really interesting. My question's about the passports. It's kind of two questions, but the first one's really small. So firstly, the passport, is it a country-wide Aboriginal Australian passport, or is it tribe-by-tribe recognition?
So it's a national passport. It's one passport. So
okay.
This is an interesting conversation. We do have many different nations, but you also have a pan-national relationship. We don't have an English translation for that other than the term Aboriginal.
Yep.
So we have a relationship with each other in a national sense. We also shared song lines,
yep.
And there's also creations as well shared. So there is one Aboriginal passport in that sense. So you don't need those passports to move between territories within this nation.
Cool.
So that's how that's used.
I think that makes good sense. The main question was, in terms of solidarity, I just had this thought of how awesome it would be if a bunch of like privileged white Australians renounced their Australian passports and tried to take up Aboriginal passports. And if they had, you know, do you think that could be a possibility at some stage?
That's a really interesting question. I'm not sure how that would look. I don't know, to be honest, if a white person could carry around an Aboriginal passport. Yeah, but, you know, who knows what happens in the future. I think while now we're using it as a form of resistance, we need to be careful about how it's used. But I certainly am excited by the idea of anybody renouncing their identity and relationship with the term Australia, mm-hmm. and any sense of that and any in all of its forms. Call it so-called Australia now. When you walk on this country, this is Wurundjeri country, this is not Melbourne. That's a resistance to the colonialism. Don't ever say real Australians say welcome. That is so offensive. Don't say that. That's saying, come here, we're going to fuck you over too. That's like, or nothing says welcome like genocide. Don't do that. That's wrong. Renounce the word Australian. Don't call yourself Australian. You know, I'm in Canada. I saw, you know, they do some really cool things over there. You know, all the white people over there call themselves settlers, and their society is settler society. You know, and I like those ideas. So I think that we can all work together in destroying this identity and this idea of this Australian nation state that has so much control in all of our lives, and it's not good for any of us, and particularly the refugee mob and Aboriginal people.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks. That was really beautiful. So just on the last point, the Australian Provisional Government, the Aboriginal Provisional Government, I'm pretty sure gives visas to non-Aboriginal people.
That's right, yes. They do have visas for non-Aboriginal people. They do have them. Actually, I forgot that they'd had them. And that's a really interesting thing to look into as well, are visas for non-Aboriginal people to be here. But also Uncle Rob Thorpe, I'm sure most of you have heard of him, but he also has passports that are used differently as well. So that might be worth looking into as well. But yeah, they do have visas. Thank you for that point.
So my question is to both of you. A lot of what we've been discussing, or what you've been discussing, is about rejecting the conditionality of citizenship, which is obviously really relevant to Mariki and to War, but also to the idea of like who's accepted as a new settler in Australia. And I think that project of rejecting the conditionality of citizenship is inherently anti-colonial, but I noticed that discourse is completely missing from the refugee mainstream discourse, and I'm wondering if that's been a strategic decision, whether that's just more acceptable. So I guess that question is to you, Lucy, but also Mariki, how would you feel, or like what's your perspective on the refugee advocacy groups explicitly claiming that anti-colonial stance?
Okay. Rejecting the conditionality of citizenship. I've just got to get my head around the language. I think the thing that there is inherent in the refugee campaign, a tension about that point, about to what extent, I guess it's kind of a question of open borders, actually. What you're talking about is a question of, you know, do we want to retain, or do we want the government to retain some control over who becomes a citizen, and have a better process, or a faster process, or a less punitive process, but maintain that control, or do we ultimately, you know, want to reject the idea of borders altogether, and you know, free movement of the people, as you know, I think Nicole put it at the beginning, as our ultimate aim. And certainly, I think, as a strategic point, there are times when we do fudge that, because there are huge amounts of people in Australia who do want to see the end of offshore detention, the end of refugee cruelty, but, you know, the idea of an open border is a bridge too far at the moment. But it's certainly nothing that I or Refugee Action Collective, for example, would ever draw the line at, or say, you know, we reject that idea. There is a bit of a push around this lately, though, particularly since since Rudd's kind of announcement of the PNG solution, when he effectively did close the borders in a more overt way than ever, you know, in not ever before, that's certainly not true, but in recent memory, where he said, you know, you'll go to Manus Island, you'll stay there, and you will never, ever come into Australia. And that kind of opened a little possibility for us to kind of raise the idea of open the borders as a demand, or as a slogan. So just because it was so obvious that was what was happening. It was a closure of the borders in the most brutal way. So, you know, I think there's been a little bit more openness about that. The second way it's come up is about boats. It's been a big, in the lead up to the ALP conference, I don't know how many people know the interstices of the refugee campaign like this, but we did have a big debate about, you know, should boat turnbacks be used, and is the demand let them land, let them stay, you know, a legitimate demand for the refugee campaign. And Refugee Action Collective kind of took that on as a project, I suppose, to make that a mainstream refugee demand, that let them land, let them stay, let the boats come, no matter what, as a demand. And I think boat arrivals, by their very nature, do question closed borders. They do kind of throw up the idea that the government can control the arrival. We control who arrives and the circumstances in which they come. Well, a boat coming here saying, I want protection as I'm entitled to, just totally disrupts that. So, yeah, to that extent, I think Refugee Action Collective does try as much as possible to chip away at that logic of, we want a state that has control and ultimate control, and I don't know how you put it, but the conditionality of citizenship. I think we do want that, but I suppose Refugee Action Collective is a very, like, we run an open kind of, and as in a lot of senses, we try and push this issue into the mainstream. So we do have a kind of strategic approach of trying to bring as many people in whilst opening the possibilities of more and more radical politics as we go. So I guess we're always on the lookout for the opportunities to do that.
Great. Any other questions? Yeah. Do you guys want to come forward maybe? And
I thought the talk was really, the questions were good, and the link between borders and like issues of like Indigenous sovereignty and struggle and tying that around colonisation. But I do think the and maybe that last question just then threw up the maybe dilemmas around it, is stuff around refugees and is basically a campaign, whereas decolonisation isn't a campaign. It's like integral to everything in Australia, and the way that the refugee movement tends to go, like, it does take steps towards the mainstream, but when we're talking about the mainstream there, we're talking about things that make more palatable to white Australia. So you're starting to move towards like that whole sentiment of real we're real Australians and we say welcome. And I understand why within campaigns people think they need to do that, but any moment we step towards that is actually in opposition to the whole discourse, to the whole struggles we want, which are to get rid of that welcoming of white Australia to everyone else. And there is already antagonism on the streets around race in this country, and it's coming from non-white people, and we don't need, you know, instead of looking at it like we need to mobilise those people, we need to be there with those people, because it's already happening. And when we're talking about needing to mobilise people, we're talking, it's what people mean is we need to mobilise white Australia, and that's when we start to take these steps towards the mainstream that are actually, I think, like taking backwards steps a lot. And it even, and I think the example in what you said about like the of how a campaign becomes problematic is when you start to focus on Tony Abbott, as if the government has, like, it's a pretty bad example situation we're in right now, of course, but this stuff is much more on the ground than the government's. But within campaigns, you know, people want to look at the government and go, oh, if we can change this shit by the next federal election, that'll be a success. But because the much harder question is how infused throughout Australian society colonisation is. That's not really a question, sorry.
That's a great point, though, so thank you. Point on that, just really quickly, is that, that's where some of the problems lie with the insult to solidarity, is when people do focus on Tony Abbott. No, like, Tony Abbott, to me, is no different to Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd, except, you know, one will stab you in the front and one will stab you in the back. And that's literally how it works. And, you know, Julia Gillard signed on to 10 years stronger futures after it was found that Aboriginal youth suicide jumped 500%. There is no good politician in this country to rely your freedoms on, and we can't do that.
I'm just going to jump in because actually that reminded me of something that I was going to ask you about, Mariki, which I think that War has put together some stuff around solidarity processes recently. So Did you want to talk about that? Because I think that will sort of also address that question.
Yeah, so we have one of the, you know, we're a young group, both in that we haven't even been going for a year. And we are just learning about how all of this works. So we've just started a solidarity database. So if anybody has stuff that they, any skills or anything that they can contribute that can help to any movements or anything that we are doing, then there is a database where you can put that information in, where we can keep that. And, you know, we can work together in a productive way to get things moving for us. Claire Land has just written a book on decolonising solidarity, and she wrote that under the guise of Gary Foley and Uncle Rob Thorpe and a lot of other contributors, and Aboriginal people who have been in resistance for a really long time, but also non-Aboriginal people who have been in resistance for a really long time. So it's really good to learn from people who have done that before. And I think that this book, I haven't read it yet. My sister's got the copy and she won't give it to me. Yeah, she hasn't finished it. But from what I understand, there's good things in that book, and I think that, you know, that's a step towards the right direction for all our different groups working together, and maybe that decolonising solidarity could might even be... I haven't read the book, so I can't talk too much of it about that, but also working in the spaces around refugee peoples, you know. I think when you're in solidarity with a group, it's nothing, you know, for us without us, that kind of... that idea, that's really important. But yeah, Claire's got a stall out there where you can buy the book and also sign up to her solidarity as well, our solidarity database there as well.
Did you have anything you wanted to say to that point,
sure.
Lucy?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of instances where it can turn into where the refugee movement in the broadest sense has been paternalistic or can be paternalistic definitely kind of appeal to the electoral politics or appeal to the ALP and attempt to try and, you know, fashion a demand that is acceptable to the elites as they are instead of pushing for what we know is justice. And from my point of view, I don't think that's what Refugee Action Collective is doing. I guess in terms of the question of solidarity and how do you fight for Aboriginal rights, how do you fight for refugee rights if you're not Aboriginal or if you're not a refugee, I guess it comes down to you have to fight. You can't just hang around. You can't, you know, I don't know, I guess the sense of trying to... me trying to decolonise myself is just, I guess, the poignancy of that question over there about, you know, can I get an Aboriginal passport? I can't, and I think it would be kind of false of me to have one. What I need to do in order to break the racism of this country is to fight it. And there are all the politics that go along with that that, you know, we all try and navigate with our various different traditions. But, yeah, I guess I just really... I really feel adamant about the fact that there's no passive solidarity. There is only getting your hands dirty and getting in there and fighting the place where this racism comes from, and that is the top of society.
Yeah, I'm from the Refugee Action Collective as well, and I just wanted to address some of the points that were made behind me. I think in terms of things like demands and the kind of language that you use around things and how radical your language is, sometimes I think that it is always good to have in the back of your mind what is the most sort of radical demand that we can put forward at this time. But I do also think that if you simply focus on talking the most radical talk, we only end up talking to ourselves. And that's sort of like we do need to breach out, you know, beyond the groups of people that we already talk to who are already convinced by, you know, campaigns for refugee rights and things like that. And another thing too is there are activists within, you know, communities of colour, within refugee communities who live here. Like, we work really strongly in solidarity with people who are Tamil, with people who are Kurdish, with people who, you know, were refugees from Iran. And, yeah, I do think that, like, without sort of fighting, like Lucy said, there just can become this real risk that any solidarity is perceived through a lens of white guilt, and that's really not particularly effective and not a particularly effective way to fight.
Did either of you two want to respond to that, or just take that as a comment?
Yep.
Yeah, thanks for everything you've said so far. I agree largely with the parallels you've drawn between... I can't see. The parallels you've drawn between Aboriginal incarceration rates and detention centres. However, I think it is also important to look at the differences. And I think one of the main differences is that Aboriginal incarceration is the most recent step in colonial control of, I think, of Aboriginal lives. First you had the frontier wars and massacres, then you had the missions and reserves, and now I think it's Aboriginal, it's locking up Aboriginal people in order to control their bodies and their lives, which I think is vastly different to what I believe is the point of immigration detention centres and concentration camps, and that is, like you said, of deterrence. So I think one is that white Australia sees Aboriginal people as this thorn in their side and this constant threat that has to be managed and controlled, where I think there's a sort of a slight difference. So that's just a comment. But also my question is, in the politics of black nationalism or Aboriginal nationalism, how is the idea of a border, of the border, thought about? I think it's probably a hard question, but I don't know if you'd like to maybe respond to it, Mariki.
Yeah, so one of our philosophies for Warriors in Aboriginal Resistance is Aboriginal nationalism, and that's basically, that's not nationalism in a colonial sense, that's not a, that's completely different to white nationalism and Australian nationalism. Ours is an organic nationalism where we have to rebuild our nations if for survival, and that's where we rebuild our Aboriginality, and that's where we draw on ourselves for strength to fight for ourselves, and that's where that's centred, that's predominantly centred around that. There's an amazing academic, he's done a lot of work around Aboriginal nationalism, and he's called his name is Daigi Alfred, and if you're really interested in learning a bit more about that and what that means, then I suggest that, you know, have a read of what some of the work that he's done about around that. But it's just as basic as us doing our work for ourselves, rebuilding the nations that were destroyed, and surviving off that. And also, I just wanted to make a point about your point. Just make a comment about your point. Yes, it's genocide. What's happening here, and the reason our children, you know, right now there are 1,500 Aboriginal children living in out-of-home care in Australia. That is the most recent round of colonialism against Aboriginal people, is that there are more Aboriginal kids in out-of-home care than at any point of the history of this country. And they're stealing that's stealing our future. They're stealing our Aboriginality, and it's genocide. It's not protecting the border. That's the difference. They are trying to kill us here.
That's a really good point. There were two questions, didn't it?
I've just got a question for Mariki about, following on from these our discussions of like campaign narratives, like that is a demand for no borders or open borders like a worthwhile thing, or are we just talking amongst ourselves? I'm just interested to hear your thoughts about that in relation to the idea of decolonisation as like a vision or a demand or something that like you're working towards, that I feel like there's a lot of parallels in talking about campaign narratives. Like decolonisation isn't something that's going to like, we're not going to be completely decolonised tomorrow, mm-hmm. but yeah, I'm just interested to hear you talk about why that's still worthwhile and important. Not just as like a demand to have of politicians or whoever, but why it's important within ourselves and our communities.
To continue to decolonise as though it's not a campaign. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Just following on from our discussions of like why, I don't know, someone mentioned that like maybe it's not worthwhile thinking about or demanding or moving towards open borders or like no borders.
Too radical.
How it's, you know, just a radical message and we're just talking to people who are already converted.
I think that's a really good question, and those kind of questions can be, you know, conveyed across a lot of campaigns, you know, and we certainly have those within the Aboriginal movements and struggles about, you know, what's too radical and what's progressive and what's going to actually get changes or keep Aboriginal people out of prisons. And those things come up all the time, and those, and that's an argument that we're constantly having with each other, and we're clashing on that. And I think that's a real issue in organising and resistance across the board that we have, and not just specifically with refugee campaigns or decolonising. And I think, you know, I think those... I'm new, you know, I understand what you're saying in that, and I don't play into party. It's not a it's not something that war does. We don't play into party politics. We don't participate in colonial politics, because that essentially undermines our sovereignty, and that becomes then tokenistic. If the mayor of Melbourne wanted to meet with us, and we didn't, because that would have undermined our sovereignty as Aboriginal people, and we don't want to meet with him. And essentially there's nothing that he can say and do to control what we say, because he essentially wanted to stop us from shutting down the streets. And he had, you know, I mean, so, yeah, we don't get involved in that, and that's a position of war, because, you know, ours is a longer-term thing, and a lot of our politics are actually directed at for Aboriginal people and not the white Australia. It's for our people to live and survive in what we're doing now. And I hope that answers your question.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I have, like, problem with that, the idea that, like, it's like if we just focus on the short term, like, oh, if we can only get this better government elected or whatever, then this will be better. It's just like, well, who is that for? Like, who is that then?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, the system's fucked. And that's basically the reality of it, and I don't have any faith that the next politician will make any change in that. But I, you know, but that's, yeah, I guess there's levels in that. But if you want to talk more,
yeah, I mean, I guess I'm for demands. I'm for putting demands on governments. I'm not for deluding ourselves that they're going to hand them over if we sit down with them and talk to them nicely. Definitely not. And Refugee Action Collective is pretty relentless in its common kind of operations of coming onto the streets and agitating openly and, you know, and struggling openly. But I think it's useful. I do think it is useful to have demands, because they raise questions and they open up those discussions. So, for example, the demand, let them land, let them stay, for example, I do think it exposes some questions that really do challenge the idea of the border. They do challenge the idea of, you know, who gets to stay, who lands, when, etc., etc. So, you know, close Manus Island, close Nauru. I do think there is something useful in naming those two places as places that must first and foremost be shut down. That doesn't mean that RAC winds itself up, you know, when we close Manus and Nauru. Obviously not. You know, we've been going for a long time before they were operating. We will operate until, you know, deterrence is in the dustbin of history. But, yeah, it's absolutely right what you were saying previously. It's a campaign group. It's a movement. It's not an identity. And I think that has strengths and weaknesses. I think the strength is that it tries to orientate to the broadest group possible by making the fiercest demands possible. And those two things are attention, but they're also, you know, they have won in the past. You know, in 2007, Rudd couldn't go to the election demanding more refugee cruelty. That's a fact, and that's a fact of the refugee movement, and I think it's a useful fact for us to remember. It's the same with the White Australia policy. You know, it's a demand. You want to end it. You want to shut down that racism that comes from the government. And you can call that decolonisation, or you can call it a campaign or whatever, but I do think that it requires people setting out a project of, you know, things that concretely we want to see the end of, and fighting for that to happen and mobilising people, you know, and keeping that up. So I guess I'm not for I'm for the open, outward looking kind of nature of a movement.
Didn't see the end of white Australia with the campaigns.
I'm just going to just quickly interrupt. It is actually the end of the session time, but we wrote the program so that we thought this session would probably want to continue on, so you're most welcome to. But we just do also be mindful that there is a medics workshop on dealing with being pepper sprayed, since that's been a bit of a recent phenomena. So if you do want to go and get yourself informed about that, that's happening in the other rooms down that way. But, yeah, we do want you to continue if you want to stay here and continue this discussion. That'd be great.
Thank you. Great, thanks for that. And, yeah, everybody leave if you want to. It looks like there's a couple more questions, so if everyone's happy to continue on while we've got a few more questions and comments, we can do that.
My comment is in relation to RISE, and I think just broadly speaking, that it's more interesting and more meaningful when the considerable amount of energy that goes into refugee issues is used to further solidarity with RISE, which should, in my opinion, be the aim.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I think RISE do a really good job, and I would encourage that.
Yeah, and I agree. If there was like a future thing like this, it would definitely be good to include them in the discussion. So, yeah, thanks. Point taken. Yeah, and over here.
Hi, this is a question from Reiki. I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about how we can change the sort of narratives that are used in sort of current refugee campaigns for the better. Like, I know you and other people from WAR have spoken about rejecting language like Real Australians Say Welcome, but also maybe questioning some of the chants that are commonly used at protests, like whose streets are streets, and also things like always was, always will be Aboriginal land when that's not led by Aboriginal people. So I was wondering if you could talk about some of the sort of practical changes we could try and make to the sort of language and narratives that we use in kind of protests, including RAC protests. And I guess the sort of other part of that is whether how we can sort of, like, how for sort of white settlers we can avoid this sort of like dodgy language of kind of welcoming people to somewhere that isn't ours, but still at the same time reject the sort of the narrative that we're responding to that says that refugees are not welcome and that they should go away. So how, because obviously, you know, you have the right to welcome people and Aboriginal people do, but I'm wondering if there are better ways we can respond to that narrative without creating this other kind of problematic thing of white people welcoming to somewhere that isn't theirs.
That's a really good question, because it's something that comes up, and I know that it's a cause of a lot of frustration for a lot of, you know, Aboriginal people when they do attend, you know, a rally in support of refugees, and then the languaging is like, you know, it can be quite offensive. When I think that comes down to not being it comes down to destroying, you know, white supremacy, resisting, you know, and destroying the identity of Australian nationalism. It's not just a quick fix, and I think that just comes out when people just completely, you know, haven't done any work within, you know, and it all starts within. You haven't done any work within about where you stand on this country and what brought you here, and the experience when you are putting all of your hard work and blood, sweat and tears into, you know, another campaign for, you know, human rights, regardless of what it is. And that should always be, you know, from the ground that you stand on and all the movements that you make, it should be, you know, something that you're thinking of all the time. But, you know, that's a really good question. And I don't know how that, because, you know, then people have come and asked us to be, you know, advisors on it. And it's hard because, you know, there's a really big anti-racism campaign happening at the moment, and there's some, you know, the people that went to those rallies and, you know, fought against the Nazis, you know, that was amazing. It was, you know, disgusting. That was horrible what happened to people, the police did to people there, and, you know, the stuff that's happened there. But, you know, sometimes Aboriginal people and voices can be tokenised. Can you come and do the welcome at this rally? No, we want to come and talk about what you think about the rally, about what we think about the issue, include Aboriginal people. It's a really interesting question, and it can be very frustrating, because then you at the rallies you see all this, it's great when we all can mobilise and get out, and 12,000 of us are standing in the streets with our fists in the air, and it's really powerful and it's amazing, and we're doing smoking ceremony, and then the next week people are saying real Australians say welcome. It's really frustrating, and the solidarity is kind of a real hit and miss. It's very interesting, and it's a long conversation, and it's something that we probably need to sit down and have a workshop on on its own.
Sorry, I know there's other people who want to ask a question. I just wanted to add my concern to the Real Australians Say Welcome. And we've had debates about those kind of slogans that appeal to nationalism on some kind of level, like, this isn't the Australia we want, or, the Real Australia, would do X, Y and Z. Apart from it being, totally imaginary in people's heads about what the Real Australia is, and usually false, almost always false, it also is very, very, like I guess what Mariki is talking about, it's very alienating for every single person who comes to those rallies who doesn't see themselves as a real Australian or wants not to see themselves as a real Australian. So, yeah, we reject most of those slogans, but all of those slogans that appeal to nationalism. But the one thing that I do think is worth maintaining is refugees are welcome here. And I know that's a bit controversial because it's, who is doing the welcoming, on whose behalf, are we asserting this welcome? I think that is problematic. But I think nonetheless it cuts so much against the racism of the Australian state, that the assertion that people, human beings, should be welcome. And I think there is enough of the interlocking racism that we spent the first half of this talking about, that I do think that it undermines both anti-Aboriginal racism and refugee racism to assert a different perspective to what the government is coming out with. So I think that's a good one.
Just really on that welcome, that there is no English translation for what a welcome is in the sense of an Aboriginal welcome. It's a different thing. What it should be saying is people deserve to be safe. People have the right to be safe. People have the right to be cared for, and regardless of where that might be, And I know that that's really hard to put in a slogan campaign, but essentially the bottom line is that we care about people, fleeing from, really bad circumstances from where they come, and they deserve to be safe and taken care of here, and the same circumstance for people living here. So, I mean, that's the undertone to it all. But essentially, for that welcome thing, it's hard to just say only Aboriginal people can say welcome. It's a really weird... A welcome has been almost taken out of context from its true meaning. It's a ceremony. It's a ceremony that's been practiced for a really long time in this country, and I'm not a sovereign person to this country. I'm Gunai and Gunijmara, but it's a ceremony about sitting with the people and learning their history and their experience and being accepted by their ancestors. It's so much more than a word. And to belittle it to one word and one little sentence at the start of anything that you do is not doing that just any disservice. So I'm not that huge on Aboriginal welcomes, because they've been taken out of context from its truer forms. So if people want to really think about an Aboriginal welcome, it's far deeper than just a welcome to country.
Thanks. My question's more in relation to, and I don't know anything really about this at all, but Indigenous law and perhaps its relationship with, the current law that we've got kind of incarcerating all these people, and where there's, ways perhaps of, I mean, it's more of just a question on that, and because I know nothing about Indigenous laws or... the relationship that has with our current legal system either, and how that can kind of play out, whether there is an ability to
kind of integrate more, I guess?
I don't think you can integrate them. Can't. The Australian laws are, they're no good. You can put gum leaves on them and smoke them for the days, and they won't even help us in any of the slightest. Like, and that you can't integrate. But you, Indigenous law is not. Again, it's not like a wealth. There's no English. It's a certain set of rules and ways of living that underpin the society and how we interact with each other in harmony, and not harmony in a let's all sit around a campfire and sing kumbaya. There was trouble, punishment, there was payback, and there was, you know, death penalties as well. I think that Indigenous law, in terms of how people should live, supersedes Australian law. Like, we didn't have suicides and deaths in custody back when Indigenous law had full sovereign control over this land. Australian law undermines Indigenous law in every sense of the way. You can't bring an Aboriginal lawman into a courtroom and try and help him make a magistrate be lenient on a sentence. It doesn't work, because the fact that they are still there in that courtroom is problematic.
I suppose that was an attempt at what Native Title was supposed to be doing as well, was making those two systems of law compatible, but actually it's turned out to be like another colonial project.
Yeah, so they all, and they are, you know, they, Native Title now is used as a tool of oppression to us, and that's a form of colonialism and genocide to our people, if you stand back and look at it for what it really is. It does not care in the slightest about, particularly in our cases, because they're all slightly different, but I know that not many people think they're great. Not many Aboriginal people agree with it. But, you know, they're just like, if we were starved out for so long and then we're given crumbs, and then some people thought those crumbs were great because they were starving for so long. But we shouldn't be hungry. No, if I can use that. Native Title, yeah, no.
Yeah. Hi. I just wanted, I'm not sure it's more of a question or just like a statement or something that I think needs to be addressed. I guess the kind of general like ideal and theme of decolonization sort of seems at odds with a lot of the kind of narratives I've been hearing of almost using like direct demands of government and the idea of the root of racism and things like that as this kind of top-down hierarchy thing of racism comes from the state just being fucked up and like, you know, we're all here because we want to smash the state. Why else would we be here today? Mm-hmm. So, like, but the idea that decolonization is more of an idea of, I don't know, de-internalizing all of the root of racism that we have experienced through growing up in a society that is colonized and growing up in a society that has taught us these hierarchies that need to be abided by for people to assimilate into that culture and to actually move towards some actual feasible change and progress towards decolonization. I think the narrative needs to move away from the state or this power figure as being a scapegoat for all of the racism that exists in society, rather than looking internally at everything that we experience in everyday life, every single little power exchange that we enact upon other people as privileged persons. And like, I do feel like I saw some of that happen just before in this room when that man was trying to make quite a strong point about how the White Australia policy and these other demands that were made have not actually made a tangible difference to the amount of racist violence that is experienced in this country by all kinds of people. So that was just the point I wanted to make and hear your thoughts on.
I guess it's really hard because, you know, a lot of the racism that we experience as Aboriginal people, well, yeah, it comes from
the notion that white culture is the most supreme, and that that is a reality, and I don't even know that I have it inside myself, and that's called white supremacy. Everybody, every single one of us harbours white supremacy, and that's the idea that systems, ideas, norms, everything comes from one place in the world called Europe, and that's not true. So it's really hard to try and help people understand the depth of where white supremacy comes from and what it looks like, and even how to rid yourself of it. But sitting with the fact that white supremacy is even a thing, I think, is really important and a good place to start. And then once you start to accept it, maybe you can even understand how it impacts how you enact it as an individual. And I guess that then goes on impacts campaigns. So I hope, yeah.
Can I respond?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, a few things. I mean, I think there is no denying that our entire society is twisted. It is deformed on a very individual and on a very social level by racism and every other kind of form of oppression that we're plagued with. I would definitely never, ever try and deny that or try and undermine anybody's attempts to address that on a personal or a social level. But I do, yeah, I guess I just think that... I don't know if you were suggesting that the decolonisation or the, you know, the personal ridding of your racism should come before, you know, taking action. I'm sorry, I can't see... Oh, there you are. Yeah, sorry. I don't know if that's what you were suggesting, but I guess I don't think that you can do it without having the argument with the people, you know, who are incarcerating so many Aboriginal people, who have extended the Northern Territory intervention, you know, who are locking people up on Manus Island. I just think that all of those things, if you try and rid yourself of racism and sit around not doing that, then have you rid yourself of racism? I just think probably not. You're probably just in a very deluded bubble. That's not meant personally. I just actually think that it's...
Well, I'm not advocating for one or the other.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And I actually think that in the process of fighting, all the better to exercise your demons. But I actually think even then, like, it's not, like, I guess I'm just really struck by the example of the Aboriginal passport, because until we get rid of what is going on in this country that is from the top, there is no way, like, I can't actually, it will be meaningless for me to travel on an Aboriginal passport. In fact, it would be offensive. And that's not from any want of trying on my part to get rid of racism. It's not from any want of trying on anybody in this room's part. It is from the structures around us that we, until we destroy them, we have no control over them. So I guess I slightly disagree that in the emphasis there.
I really agree that it's important to take action and not just, like, sit about, you know, navel-gazing. But I think there's, like, a bit of a, like a complex relationship with where racism comes from, because I feel like partly, like, certainly, like, the elites, like, the media and the government, like, exploit people's fears to their own purposes, but also racism has a history of coming from, like, ordinary white Australians and, like, you know, even when the, like, White Australia policy was being enacted, it was a lot of, like, labour rights movements, people who were behind that. Not that there weren't heaps of working class people who were against it as well, but, yeah, I feel like it's, like, more widespread throughout, like, the whole of, like, white people in Australia is, like, have possession of this really valuable thing, which is, like, control over this, like, really valuable land. And I feel like it's, you know... like, the majority of white people aren't necessarily going to be convinced to give that up willingly if you make, like, a really, like, compelling moral argument, because, you know, you can try and tell someone to do the right thing. It doesn't mean they're going to do it. And I guess, like, to me, I see maybe, like, it's about people trying to, like, take that power by force or take that back by force. And, like, there's a long history between Aboriginal people and, like, other oppressed people. Like, in the 30s, a group of Aboriginal people went and like protested at the German consulate against the treatment of like Jewish people under the Nazis. And so like there's this long history of different oppressed people like working together in Australia. But for me, I guess the question is like, how is like those groups of oppressed people and like the people who want to support them going to like actually like take power back by force in, like, I don't mean force, like necessarily like take up arms, but I just mean like rather than trying to like appeal to people's sense of justice, which may not always work or something.
Did either of you two want to respond to that? Or?
Yeah, I'll have a go. Okay, I think one thing to take, well, that I take heart in is the fact that racism is not a consistent, it is a consistent fact in Australia, that's for sure, but it ebbs and flows. And public opinion and the extent of racism and the depths in which people hold their racist opinion changes frequently. You know, and there is that classic public opinion survey about, you know, in 2001, majority of people didn't want boats to land, didn't want it ever to happen. By 2004, the majority did. They said that, you know, boats should land and they should be processed. And that was a process of challenging that racism and kind of having an active campaign against it. And I guess it does point to the, noticing that and understanding that there isn't a ready-made fact that the working class and ordinary people, whomever they may be, are necessarily going to be racist. I think if you start from the point of view that they will be, and you start from the point of view that they cannot be changed and that they are, you know, they are lost forever, then, you know, there is no winning. But I don't think that's true, and I just think I acknowledge that he left, but you know, he said that we haven't won the White Australia policy for all intents and purposes still exists, but in other senses it doesn't. You know, it has been broken in the sense that the policy was broken. There are people here who are allowed to come who aren't white. Now that is very small. It is very minimal, but you know, it points to the fact that you can challenge the thing. You can break it. You know, I guess other really important things that I take heart in, you know, the Vietnam War, it's the same thing. You know, it was a thing that, you know, it seemed like most people were in favour of it, and then a consistent campaign of a militant minority and more who believed that that wasn't necessarily going to be the case forever went out, fought for it, broke it, and with breaking it, brought into, you know, the imaginary possibility so many other things. And so, yeah, absolutely, you know, like you look at the labour movement at the moment and it is in a totally diabolical state where you've got on the one hand this gruesome campaign for, you know, get rid of Chinese workers and the free trade agreement with China is a disaster and they're taking our jobs and our women and what have you. And on the other hand, you have quite a seriously strong position on refugee rights. You have, you know, the ACTU is insistent of all its member organisations that this should be the case, you know, that there should be refugees allowed to land, allowed to stay, no more Manus, no more Nauru. So, you know, there is a tension, and wherever there's a tension, you can work with that, you know. And I guess I'll talk another time. I dispute the history of the White Australia politics. I absolutely agree that, you know, unions were on board with it, but it went back much further and deeper to that, to the pastoralists. And, you know, Melbourne is case in point, you know, like the 1830s, they were stuck in Tasmania. The pastoralists had run out of land. They wanted more. They came to Melbourne. You know, there were Aboriginal people in the way. They just kind of, like, that's it. Get rid of them. It wasn't convicts. It wasn't, you know, labourers. It was absolutely the people who wanted to make the cash out of the land. And I think that not to say and not to excuse for any moment the fact of racism and the fact that working class people absolutely channel it, use it, run with it, enact it in the most horrific ways, but I will not accept that that cannot be challenged.
Can I just do a bit of a check-in? How are you guys feeling? I think we've run about half an hour over already, and I know that this could probably keep going, but I thought, yeah, one more question? Yep. I'm seeing a hand down here. Was there anyone else who's more pressing? Was there somebody else that was burning to ask the last question?
Sorry, I'm really front, but... So we're just talking about tactics and stuff, and like you said, stuff like that non-white people are now, as a result of white, you know, people's campaigns, non-white people can come now. The white Australia policy doesn't exist. But, like, genocide existed then, it exists now. Like, so there's something wrong with white people's campaigns. Like, their tactics don't work. And it's not like decolonisation and solidarity, like, we need to look at a different way. Because if genocide's happening, and sure, some changes might happen to our, you know, the fucked up society that this white Australia's created, but like if genocide's still happening, it doesn't matter that changes happen, like then you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that should be the marker that we're doing some white campaigning is doing something wrong. If genocide continues, our strategies are wrong.
Seems like there's kind of two things going on there. It's partly pessimism versus optimism, but there is also like something there to be said around like the white Australia policy. Has it actually ended? Genocide is certainly still continuing. I'd probably say the white Australia policy still continues, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wouldn't disagree with either. I mean, genocide is still going on. The white Australia policy is still going on. The Australian state is, you know, as racist as it has ever been. That is totally a fact, but. Yeah, we haven't won. I'm not declaring victory by any stretch. I guess I'm saying though that there are battles, not the war, but the battles we can make inroads, and we have made inroads. And I guess you can look at it in the long view and say we haven't won, so step back, or you can look at it, you know, a little bit more closely and say, yeah, the white Australia's policy. It was dismantled.
I guess what I'm saying is that if those people had been fighting the white Australia policy had done it, like, if they'd been, you know, not being genocidal, or, you know, if they were working with Aboriginal people and supporting their sovereignty and recognising their sovereignty, then it would be completely different.
So who are we talking about?
I mean, I think you're right in one sense, in that there were a group of kind of bureaucratic types who, from the top, wanted to dismantle the White Australia policy from the top. And they were, you know, it wasn't a kind of a grassroots campaign. It was, oh, our trade's not going so well with Singapore because we look so racist. That's shameful. Like, let's take it apart from the top. And absolutely right. I agree with you. To that extent, that is a very, very shallow campaign. I guess I'm talking about from the bottom up, though, and the anti-racist campaigns that try and do things from the bottom up. I don't think there is a disconnect necessarily in what we're saying about that solidarity, and that there is no stopping. There is no victory until genocide is over, the Australian state is broken, you know, refugees are allowed to come and stay and go and stay or whatever.
Do you want to comment on that, Mariki? No. Mariki's looking. And thanks, everyone, for coming. And thank you so much to Mariki and Lucy because they've had an awesome conversation. Great. And just finally, yeah, this was recorded and it will be podcast on Women Online in the next few weeks. And I'll put a link of the whole thing up somewhere as well.